13. The movement ought to educate its adherents to the principle that struggle must not be considered a necessary evil, but as something to be desired in itself. Therefore, they must not be afraid of the hostility which their adversaries manifest towards them, but they must take it as a necessary condition on which their whole right to existence is based. They must not try to avoid being hated by those who are the enemies of our people and our philosophy of life, but must welcome such hatred. Lies and calumnies are part of the method which the enemy employs to express his chagrin. The man who is not opposed and vilified and slandered in the Jewish press is not a staunch German, and not a true National Socialist. The best rule whereby the sincerity of his convictions, his character, and strength of will can be measured is the hostility which his name arouses among the mortal enemies of our people. The followers of the movement, and indeed the whole nation, must be reminded again and again of the fact that through the medium of his newspapers, the Jew is always spreading falsehood, and that if he tells the truth on some occasions, it is only for the purpose of masking some greater deceit, which turns the apparent truth into a deliberate falsehood. The Jew is the great master of lies. Falsehood and duplicity are the weapons with which he fights. Every calumny and falsehood published by the Jews are tokens of honor which can be worn by our comrades. He whom they decry most is nearest to our hearts, and he whom they mortally hate is our best friend. If a comrade of ours opens a Jewish newspaper in the morning and does not find himself vilified there, then he has spent yesterday to no account. For if he had achieved something, he would be persecuted, slandered, derided, and abused. Those who effectively combat this mortal enemy of our people, who is at the same time the enemy of all Aryan peoples and all culture, can only expect to arouse opposition on the part of this race and become the object of its slanderous attacks. When these truths become part of the flesh and blood, as it were, of our members, then the movement will be impregnable and invincible. 14. The movement must use all possible means to cultivate respect for the individual personality. It must never forget that all human values are based on personal values, and that every idea and achievement is the fruit of the creative power of one man. We must never forget that admiration for everything that is great is not only a tribute to one creative personality, but that all those who feel such admiration become thereby united under one covenant. Nothing can take the place of the individual, especially if the individual embodies in himself not the mechanical element, but the element of cultural creativeness. No pupil can take the place of the master in completing a great picture which he has left unfinished. And just in the same way, no substitute can take the place of the great poet or thinker, or the great statesman or military general, for the source of their power is in the realm of artistic creativeness. It can never be mechanically acquired, because it is an innate product of divine grace. The greatest revolutions and the greatest achievements of this world Its greatest cultural works and the immortal creations of great statesmen are inseparably bound up with one name which stands as a symbol for them in each respective case. The failure to pay tribute to one of those great spirits signifies a neglect of that enormous source of power which lies in the remembrance of all great men and women. The Jew himself knows this best. He, whose great men have always been great only in their efforts to destroy mankind and its civilization, takes good care that they are worshipped as idols. But the Jew tries to degrade the honor in which nations hold their great men and women. He stigmatizes this honor as the cult of personality. As soon as a nation has so far lost its courage as to submit to this impudent defamation on the part of the Jews, it renounces the most important source of its own inner strength. This inner force cannot arise from a policy of pandering to the masses, but only from the worship of men of genius, whose lives have uplifted and ennobled the nation itself. When men's hearts are breaking and their souls are plunged into the depths of despair, their great forebears turn their eyes towards them from the dim shadows of the past, those forebears who knew how to triumph over anxiety and affliction, mental servitude and physical bondage, and extend their eternal hands in a gesture of encouragement to despairing souls. Woe to the nation that is ashamed to clasp those hands. During the initial phase of our movement, our greatest handicap was the fact that none of us were known, and our names meant nothing, a fact which then seemed to some of us to make the chances of final success problematical. Our most difficult task, then, was to make our members firmly believe that there was a tremendous future in store for the movement, and to maintain this belief as a living faith, for at that time only 6, 7, or 8 persons came to hear one of our speakers. Consider that only 6 or 7 poor devils, who were entirely unknown, came together to found a movement which should succeed in doing what the great mass parties had failed to do, namely, to reconstruct the German Reich, even in greater power and glory than before. We should have been very pleased if we were attacked or even ridiculed. But the most depressing fact was that nobody paid any attention to us whatever. This utter lack of interest in us caused me great mental pain at that time. When I entered the circle of those men, there was not yet any question of a party or a movement. I have already described the impression which was made on me when I first came into contact with that small organization. Subsequently, I had time and also the occasion to study the form of this so-called party, which had at first made such a woeful impression. The picture was indeed quite depressing and discouraging. There was nothing, absolutely nothing at all. There was only the name of a party, and the committee consisted of all the party members. Somehow or other, it seemed just the kind of thing we were about to fight against, a miniature parliament. The voting system was employed. When the great parliament cried until they were hoarse, at least they shouted over problems of importance, here This small circle engaged in interminable discussions as to the form in which they might answer the letters which they were delighted to have received. Needless to say, the public knew nothing of all this. In Munich, nobody knew of the existence of such a party, not even by name, except our few members and their small circle of acquaintances. Every Wednesday, what was called a committee meeting was held in one of the cafes, and a debate was arranged for one evening each week. In the beginning, all the members of the movement were also members of the committee. Therefore, the same persons always turned up at both meetings. The first step that had to be taken was to extend the narrow limits of this small circle and get new members. But the principal necessity was to utilize all the means at our command for the purpose of making the movement known. We chose the following methods. We decided to hold a monthly meeting to which the public would be invited. Some of the invitations were typewritten, and some were written by hand. For the first few meetings, we distributed them in the streets and delivered them personally at certain houses. Each one canvassed among his own acquaintances and tried to persuade some of them to attend our meetings. The result was lamentable. I still remember how once I personally delivered 80 of these invitations, and how we waited in the evening for the crowds to come. After waiting in vain for a whole hour, the chairman finally had to open the meeting. Again, there were only 7 people present. The old, familiar 7. We then changed our methods. We had the invitations written with a typewriter in a Munich stationer's shop, and then multigraphed them. The result was that a few more people attended our next meeting. The number increased gradually from 11 to 13 to 17 to 23 and finally to 34. We collected some money within our own circle, each poor devil giving a small contribution, and in that way we raised sufficient funds to be able to advertise one of our meetings in the Munich Observer, which was still an independent paper. This time we had an astonishing success. We had chosen the Munich Hofbrauhauskeller, which must not be confounded with the Munich Hofbrauhaus Festsaal, as our meeting place. It was a small hall and would accommodate scarcely more than 130 people. To me, however, the hall seemed enormous, and we were all trembling lest this tremendous edifice would remain partly empty on the night of the meeting. At 7 o'clock, 111 persons were present, and the meeting was opened. A Munich professor delivered the principal address, and I spoke after him. That was my first appearance in the role of public orator. The whole thing seemed a very daring adventure to Herr Harrer, who was then chairman of the party. He was a very decent fellow, but he had an a priori conviction that, although I might have quite a number of good qualities, I certainly did not have a talent for public speaking. Even later, he could not be persuaded to change his opinion. But he was mistaken. 20 minutes had been allotted to me for my speech on this occasion, which might be looked on as our first public meeting. I talked for 30 minutes, and what I always had felt deep down in my heart, without being able to put it to the test, was here proved to be true. I could make a good speech. At the end of the 30 minutes, it was quite clear that all the people in the little hall had been profoundly impressed. The enthusiasm aroused among them found its first expression in the fact that my appeal to those present brought us donations which amounted to 300 marks. That was a great relief for us. Our finances were at that time so meagre that we could not afford to have our party prospectus printed, or even leaflets. Now we possessed at least the nucleus of a fund from which we could pay the most urgent and necessary expenses. But the success of this first larger meeting was also important from another point of view. I had already begun to introduce some young and fresh members into the committee. During the long period of my military service, I had come to know a large number of good comrades whom I was now able to persuade to join our party. All of them were energetic and disciplined young men who, through their years of military service, had been imbued with the principle that nothing is impossible, and that where there's a will, there's a way. The need for this fresh blood supply became evident to me after a few weeks of collaboration with the new members. Herr Harrer, who was then chairman of the party, was a journalist by profession, and as such he was a man of general knowledge. But as leader of the party, he had one very serious handicap. He could not speak to the crowd. Though he did his work conscientiously, it lacked the necessary driving force, probably for the reason that he had no oratorical gifts whatsoever. Herr Drexler, at that time chairman of the Munich local group, was a simple working man. He, too, was not of any great importance as a speaker. Moreover, he was not a soldier. He had never done military service, even during the war. So that this man, who was feeble and diffident by nature, had missed the only school which knows how to transform diffident and weakly natures into real men. Therefore, neither of those two men were of the stuff that would have enabled them to stir up an ardent and indomitable faith in the ultimate triumph of the movement, and to brush aside with obstinate force, and if necessary with brutal ruthlessness, all obstacles that stood in the path of the new idea. Such a task could be carried out only by men who had been trained body and soul in those military virtues which make a man, so to speak, agile as a greyhound, tough as leather, and hard as crook steel.